Wanna go, pretty boy?
Two minutes by yourself and you feel shame, you know, and then you get free.
The only thing better than a glass of beer is tea with Miss McGill.
And welcome to the Fourth Line Voice Podcast. My name is Darren. Thank you very much for tuning in. Episode 334 of the big show, some enforcer-based podcasting coming at you, brought to you by the Hockey Podcast Network. How's everybody doing out there? Oh, you're hearing me? It's the power of editing, folks. I am, as you're listening to this, I am in Sin City, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Sure. You probably get this a lot. This isn't the real Caesar's Palace, is it?
What do you mean?
Did Caesar live here?
No.
I didn't think so.
That's right. As you're listening to this, hopefully cashing some tickets. We'll see what happens, but I'm going to enjoy this vacation. Of course, I'm recording this this intro Monday night. We leave here Tuesday morning, bright and early, so I'm going to wrap this up quick. I'm not going to talk to you for long, but I have a very special guest today, Jonathan Aitken. Yes, former Boston Bruin and Chicago Blackhawk and Calder Cup champion and old WHL boy, you know. So I think you guys will really dig it. Jonathan was a great guest, and I want to thank him again for coming on the show. And, yeah, so other than that, like I said, I got to go pack, so I'm not going to talk for long. And no one's tuning in to listen to me anyway. But before, you know, got a few odds and ends. Well, I got a few odd folks to talk about. We'll start with Joel Lazito out in New York, Coliseum Chronicles podcast. He's uploaded the Mick Fakoda, the last episodes he's doing. Mick Fakoda. And I think he does, I can't remember how many parts the Mick Fakoda interview is. But I will say, I've always said that his Mick Fakoda interview is probably the best player interview podcast ever done. I will say that now. So I think even if you weren't a big fan of Fakoda's or whatever, I would check it out because Mick is a very entertaining guest, and him and Joe have a great rapport, and it's a really great interview. Great WHL stories. He's a great storyteller. So you'll dig it. Believe me. Go check it out. And yes, and then Alec over at the Five for Fighting podcast, who was my guest on the last episode, we did a East Coast League preview. I always say he's my East Coast League correspondent, and he brought us up to date on who to watch for this year and some early season. It was a early season, or what is it? Preseason power rankings in terms of fighters. We did that, and it was a lot of fun. So I encourage you to check out my last episode. Also, like I said, Alex's show, the Five for Fighting podcast. He is about to have Luke Gazdick on. He is recording on Thursday with Luke. So, and he's asking for questions. So hit him up on the Facebooks or the Instagram and drop a question for Luke, and that'll be a real fun interview. I was a big Gazdick fan, so that'll be cool. So, and again, check out his YouTube channel with some East Coast League fights on it, the Five for Fighting podcast YouTube channel, as well as my boy Jay out in Iowa, D, like the letter D, skunk, like the animal, YouTube channel. And he has, he's got last year's Southern Pro League stuff, but he goes back to like the old, we were actually checking out his back catalog the other night. Oh, he's got some like McIntyre Quad City stuff on there, some Little John. He's got some really cool old UHL stuff, and like, yeah, so I highly encourage you to subscribe to that YouTube channel. And as well, Fourth Line Voice on YouTube. I have over 2,000 videos on my channel. All the leagues are represented, so whatever league you're a fan of, type it in, and they're all sorted and blah, blah, blah. Again, I'd love it if you subscribe to the channel. And if you happen to watch a fight on my channel or Jay's or Alex that you enjoy, hit the little thumbs up button. Yeah, I know it's a corny deal, but like YouTube loves that shit and it helps in the algorithms. So yeah, that'd be cool if you could do that. And if you're listening to my show or Joe's or Alex, like I said, on the podcast, iTunes or Spotify or whatever platform you listen to it, if you could rate the show, the little star rating there, again, it helps us out in the algorithms. And I always say you're going there to hit play anyway. So if you could just, the star thing's right above it, just hit that. And that'd be really cool if you could do that. So it would be greatly appreciated. But other than that, folks, I don't have much to say. You know, like I said, I got to get ready for my vacation here. So I'm going to be gone for this week, and I'll be back on Sunday. And I was going to put, I interviewed John Morasty about 4 years, 2019. And with, of course, with Shoresy coming out this weekend, season two, and, you know, and his appearance on Spit and Chiglets 2 weeks ago, and it's kind of like Morasty mania here a little bit, and I was going to jump on the bandwagon and re-upload my Morasty interview. It's on my, if you go back through my back episodes, it's in the, I've done 330, so I can't remember. It would be very, like, one of my first 30 interviews, one of them's Morasty. And that's on my old platform. Like, it's on iTunes and Spotify. You'll have to go way back and look if you wanted to listen to it. But I was just going to re-upload it and stuff just for, like, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then get the Aiken interview out. But I went back and listened to it. And, man, I know John was in his car. I can't remember where he was traveling to. And just with the Bluetooth and stuff, the quality just isn't... Like, you can hear him and everything, but it's just, like, the quality isn't really good. Which, and I couldn't, like I said, after 332 or 34 shows, I couldn't remember. And I went back tonight and I was listening. I'm like, ew, this is a little rough. It's pretty decent in spots, but then it gets rough again. And I'm like, ah, I don't know if I want to put this out. I don't know. I talked to John a couple weeks back and we've talked about him coming back on the show anyway. So once I get back from Vegas, I'll talk to him again and I'll get him on and we can talk about Shoresy and, Ice Wars and stuff. Cause he's involved in that now. So. You know, I kind of want to do his five toughest opponents thing. Maybe we'll do that. So, but anyway, he's already said we'd do it and stuff. We just got to make a time. So, yeah, so that'll be coming up in a bit. But, anyway, my guest today, Jonathan Aiken, we talked for a while. And like I said, great guest, been around, talk some fights, talk some old dub stuff. It's pretty cool. So I think you'll dig it. Talks about going to Bruins camp and hanging out with Otzi and Ray Ray and the boys. So, yeah, I think you'll definitely dig this interview. Once again, I want to thank Jonathan for taking the time to sit down and talk to me for a couple hours. And, yeah, it was cool, man. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And, I gotta go. I'm off to Vegas. So, when I'm down there, we'll have the laptop and stuff and we're farting around in the room. I'll drop some pictures and, you know, drop some Vegas updates. Hopefully it's good news. But follow me on Twitter and Facebook, Fourth Line Voice. Oh, by the way, that's right. I'm actually on Instagram. I finally signed up for Instagram. I have no idea how it works. I have all of one post on there. But Fourth Line THPN I'm sure if you typed in Fourth Line Voice podcast, I'd come up. So I think I tried to do it. I made a profile like a while back and then just like never posted anything. And now I can't remember how to get into it and stuff. I have like 100 and some followers and I haven't followed anybody, I don't think. But I was like, I think I'm going to try to delete that profile and then just stick with this one and I'll start using it. So, but I am on Instagram, so check it out. Anyway, folks, yeah, time to get on the big jet airliner. All right, I can't even begin to tell you how excited I am to finally have, not only to be going to Vegas, of course, but just to have a vacation. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, so I'm really looking forward to it. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this, my interview with Jonathan Aiken. And yeah, when I get back, hopefully I'll have some stories for you. So I'll talk to you guys on Sunday. Thanks, everybody. All right, here on the Fourth Line Voice, I have a special guest, Jonathan Aiken, on the show. Jonathan, how you doing today?
Good, Darren. How you doing, pal?
Very good. I appreciate you coming on, and we're gonna do the deep dive here on your career, and we'll timeline it. We'll go through it all here from the American League to the NHL and the highs and lows and everything. But I guess we got to start at the beginning. Where were you born and raised, and where did you play your minor hockey?
Born in Edmonton, Alberta. Lived and grew up in Sherwood Park, obviously just a little suburb of Edmonton. Played my minor hockey through the Sherwood Park Minor Hockey Association, which is now, I guess, separated to Kings Club and this and that. But yeah, it's always seemed to come back after leaving for juniors and then pro, and always seemed to come back to the Edmonton area. Obviously, you know, family stayed here. You know, it's a hockey hotbed like most of Canada is. So I kind of wonder why you keep coming back, especially when you're, you know, not playing anymore and retired and living in, you know, minus 40 weather. I kind of have to look at myself in the mirror and say, what were you thinking? But yeah, Edmonton born and raised.
I every minus 40 morning, I look at my wife and tell us as we sit here in Saskatoon saying, what are we thinking? But here we are. But
yeah.
Well, and just growing up, I mean, you know, 6'4", 220, you're a big dude, physical guy when you played, you know, on the playing D there. Growing up, were you kind of always like, you know, a physical kid, or did that kind of, you grow into that sort of?
I think, you know, I've obviously been the one of the, you know, I wasn't always the biggest. I grew steadily. I never had growing spurts where I was like short and then big and short and big or whatever. You know, I was always steadily the bigger, one of the bigger guys on the team. And I guess it just came naturally to be that physical. Cause I think, you know, as you start getting to the higher levels of hockey, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're being a big guy. You're noticeable if you're not doing anything, but you're also noticeable when you're, you know, moving the puck and hitting and being involved. So you'd rather be the latter than the first, the kid that's just standing there doing nothing. So I kind of, you know, I had Scottish parents, had blue collar parents that worked extremely hard. So they always instilled the work ethic and tenacity, and you didn't have to always be the most skilled kid out there, but you better be the hardest working one type thing. So I guess that just kind of came with the, on the menu, you know, each and every practice and game, you kind of put that part, what you can control, right? You can always control the shots or the, you know, the passes, but you can always control your effort. And that was always something that we had to do as kids in our house.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, like you said, you grow up through the minor hockey system. And of course, you know, being in Western Canada, of course, there's the WHL Bantam Draft. And, of course, in 1993, you were taken 12th overall in the Bantam Draft by the Medicine Hat Tigers. I was looking at that in the first round, the 16 guys in the first round, five of them went on to play, yourself and four others went on to play in the NHL. So pretty solid Bantam Draft back then. But, at that point, because I know, well, I guess the point of my question is, you also played five games in the Alberta Junior League with Sherwood Park. Now, at that point, were you thinking Junior A, I'm going to go to college, or was it, no, I'm playing in the dub? Like, what was the thought process there?
I would have played the whole season as a 15-year-old. Like, obviously, a good friend of mine that we grew up with, obviously, everyone would know Chris Phillips from Fort McMurray, and obviously drafted number one the same year that in my draft year. Him and I were, like, kind of, you know, a 1-2 punch, if you want to call it, for defense and, young, talented kids coming up through Northern Alberta, especially. I ended up getting sick during those tryouts with the Crusaders, and I can't remember exactly what I got sick with, but I knew there was like water, you know, around my heart at that time. So I don't know what it was called, but my mom remembers it quite like it was yesterday. And I remember, all I remember is being in the hospital, you know, having not too good bowel movements in the hospital as a 15-year-old kid. And then you're like, what's going on type thing. But, you know, yeah, so I only ended up playing those five games, but then I finished the year with the U18 midget team in Sherwood Park and did the, had a good year, I guess. You know, you look back at it now and you talk to your buddies that you played with. It was, you know, obviously they're saying, well, you were always the guy that they were putting you out there. And I don't really recall that. I just remember playing and doing the thing that you do. But yeah, it would have been nice to play as a 15-year-old, but I wasn't thinking NCAA at all. Like, it was all Western Hockey League. And obviously that time, it's still like that, you know, where you have a lot of everything in your face with the Western Hockey League, with the scouts and going around all the rinks, and you don't have the NCAA front and center back then anyways. Right now you have showcases and everything else, that these schools go to. So back then it was always Western Hockey League. And I remember, you know, he got a letter in the mail, you know, after, he got a phone call from Dennis Polonich, who was our GM at the time in Medicine Hat. And he's like, congratulations, we've selected you. And, you know, and you're like, my dad was more happy than me doing backflips down the hallway than I was, you know, like I was extremely happy, but I was like, no, it's it works to start now, right? To prove yourself that you can live up to the hype or live up to that selection. So yeah, it was always WGL or bust for me at that time.
Well, let's get into it, right? So here we are, 94, 95, you're 16 years old, you roll into Medicine Hat. Well, that's another thing too. It's that, you know, you're not really going that far from home. You know, you're staying in Alberta, you're going to Medicine Hat. Looking at the roster at the time, that year, ton of Alberta guys on that roster. So I'm sure you were probably fairly familiar with a few of these guys. How was that first camp at 16? You know, here you are, the big first overall pick in the draft, big dude coming in playing D. And I mean, those WHL camps back then, that was Thunderdome, man. You were fighting for your life sometimes. How did that first camp go? Well, you made the team, obviously, but how was that first initial training camp and going in and getting your feet wet in Medicine Hat that year?
Oh, I remember, like, obviously at the end of my year, I'll go back a bit further to when I went up to Medicine Hat towards the end of the year after my, you know, the AJ or my stint with the Crusaders and obviously U18. I went down there and practiced with the guys and watched a couple games as the season came to a close for them down there. And it was like, I remember Justin Hawking was I think he was the captain. Obviously, I don't know. I can't remember if he was 19 that year and then going pro the Knicks or if he was playing as a 20-year-old. But I just remember walking into the dressing room and it's like, he's coming out of the shower butt naked and, you know, doing what they do out of the shower, right? And he's like, hey, nice to meet you. He's got his hand after he's touching, you know, cleaning himself off. He's like, do I shake this guy's hand? And as he's standing there butt naked and I'm 15-year-old kid just like in awe of, you know, being in the surroundings that I was in. So that was my first impression of the guys going down there. It was like, holy shit, these are men, right? Like,
yeah. 19,
20-year-old young men. So it was like, yeah, I still have a lot of work to do here. And you know, but yeah, my first camp, it was obviously at Josh Green, Rocky Thompson, Jeremy Schaefer, Mark Polak, Henry Kuster. We had some, you know, Stacey Roost was the captain at the time there, and it was you know, seeing him play, and it was just, you know, it was like, you're like, well, man, I'm here, but I gotta perform. So you always had that in the back of your mind. You didn't want, but at the same time, you're coming in, you're like, oh, you don't want to piss anyone off, you don't want to run a guy and, you know, be physical. And but then at the same time, you said, well, you have to make an impression, you know, in some shape or form. And that, you know, what easier impression can you do is hit a guy or be physical on a guy or take his, you know, a good defensive play and then, you know, strip the puck off him or whatever. So I remember Stacey was a pretty intense guy, and I remember rubbing him out a little bit, maybe a little bit too hard for his liking at the time, right? Because he was a 19, 20-year-old, very gifted offensive player. He didn't take it too well, and he, you know, usually ends up slashing you, like, hey, watch who you're touching type thing, right? So that was my really first impression of main camp in my first WHL camp. It was, or I guess it would have been my second in the sense of going as a 15-year-old kid, right? But going into my first season, that was it was game on.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, there's obviously, you know, here in the fourth line voice being the kind of the pro fight show and everything else, I got to ask you, because of course he went on to legendary minor league status, and I remember watching him obviously play junior here in Medicine Hat, but Rocky Thompson, what, like, they don't get much tougher than old Rocky Hockey. What was it like, how was he to be around, and did he kind of, you know, did you kind of give you any pointers or anything? I mean, being the boxer and everything, what was your experience with Rocky?
Rocky, real class act. Like, he was such a genuine guy, and I'm not just saying this because of where he is right now. You know, doing the coaching thing. He's very smart, right? Like, I think we find a lot of these guys that were in that position, as you see it now, very, very smart with the game. And, you know, being a boxer, you know, Golden Gloves and stuff. Obviously, you know, he wasn't the biggest guy. And, you know, he fought guys that were, you know, probably 10, 15 pounds, 20 pounds on him. But he was so smart and, you know, was able to throw both left and right. So that, you know, you, after practice, you sit there and you're like, well, who can you talk to and kind of get some help? Because, you know, getting in that first fight where you're taking your helmets off at that time and squaring off with a guy, you know, it's you get the butterflies in there, right?
Yeah.
You're a little bit nervous. You know, getting punched in the head is one thing, you know, in comparison to throwing the punch, right? So you would rather keep throwing them than getting hit. So he was more than a great teammate to help in that fact. And obviously having him on your team, it gave you that extra confidence knowing that you can play your game and not worry about any repercussions, because he's one taught you how to, you know, teach you a couple pointers here and there to help you hold your own. And obviously if something, you know, got a little bit out of hand as a 16-year-old, he was there to help, you know, be behind you and support you.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, and the WHL, that, I mean, it was always, but that mid-90s, like, there was killers on, like, every team. Like, every team had guys that it was just, like, stacked up. And, you know, all the, every team, every road, every barn you went into, there was, you know, guys waiting. And, but you guys had a tough team. I mean, you know, you had, you know, Rocky and, of course, Clint Cabana, you know, Blair St. Martin. There's another guy, Dr. Blair St. Martin nowadays, but he's a pretty tough dude for being undersized. He could really go. But there's a name I got to ask you about. He only played a couple games there, and the stories of him are sort of legendary. Of course, he went on to set the all-world penalty minute record in the SJHL with 700. But do you remember Calvin Crowe?
Yes. Yes, I do. Calvin Crowe. Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah, he was a piece of work. Great guy, great team guy. Like everyone that I come across in hockey, like teammates especially, like, you know, they're all great guys, good people. Good, you know, just obviously, you know, when you're going through, you know, when you can, you know, indulge into the alcohol and beer and whatever, as you have your team parties and you have these, you know, you have the characters, right? You always have that one or two guys that are just know how to get a party started and know how to entertain people. And, you know, obviously Rocky was one of them, where he would always be, you know, the storyteller and, you know, the laugh and the joke. And then you have Calvin that was kind of did the more physical stuff that I can vaguely remember. But yeah, he had that dumb look on his face. Like, what do you mean? Like, this is just me. You know, he kind of like the old bobblehead, right? Just kind of, but yeah, great guy. Yeah, it was, I could just imagine, though, like, it was a short cup of coffee with mention that, but yeah, it was one to remember for sure. That's a blast from the past, that name, for sure.
Absolutely. Of course, he got traded over to the Seattle Thunderbirds and had some great tilts in Seattle when he was there. Him and Dale Purington, like, just hammer each other later that year. But big dude, tough guy. Yeah, how do you get 723 penalty minutes in one season? Yeah, in Nipawin in the SJHL. There you go, folks. That's the most penalty minutes you'll ever hear about. But I'd love to get a hold of that guy and get him on the show. But well, like you said, and it's like you talk about. You know, now all of a sudden, back then it was in the WHL. It was, you know, pop the helmets, we're squaring off, and let's go. And obviously, you have butterflies. I'm going to test your memory here. I got it here in front of me. Do you remember who your first Western Hockey League fight was against?
Oh, it was in Medicine Hat. It was against Moose Jaw, if I remember correctly. But I cannot put the name to the face right now.
Well,
maybe you.
Well, what I have in front of me is December 28th in Lethbridge against Byron Ritchie.
Well, that could have been a close second, but I always thought I had it. We were at home in the old Medicine Hat, but Byron Ritchie, yeah, he was a guy that can play, and you just didn't know what he was going to do. Hence, why he was able to play in the NHL for the number of years that he did. But yeah, I had the reach on him, I had the height on him, but yeah, it was. I remember that fight for sure. And it was, you know, then you had not only him, but you had all those other guys, some big D-men, and Brent Sopel was playing on that team as well, and everything else. So, yeah, it was, yeah, he was a tough customer for sure.
Yeah.
Good way to break it in.
Well, another fight you had was here in what was in Medicine Hat, but against the Blades was Shane Calder.
There's some of these names, like, you remember the fight, but you don't remember the names. And then all of a sudden, when, like yourself, you just say the name and say, yeah, I remember. And, you had Wade Belak. I think Sobel was on that team first, and then he was traded to Lethbridge when they made that run a couple years later and stuff like that. But yeah, I remember we would always go into Saskatoon, and it was either, Rocky fighting these guys, and, you had to step up and help out, just not to let him have to carry all that weight. But then you're also worrying about how you want to score goals, because they had the old Mark Dayal and Frankie Banham duels getting, Frankie was obviously the trigger man, and then Dayal was always the setup guy, and they would have 5-6 points each by the end of the night when we played them, especially my first year. So it was it was a blast playing against them. Obviously harder to play in Saskatoon, but it was good competition when we were playing them at home.
Well, yeah, it's just like, just looking, like you said, you go into Saskatoon. Well, you look at Saskatoon's roster at the time, like you said, you had Clark Wilm, Rhett Warner, Ryan Tobler, Wade Belak, Lee Sorokin, Chris McAllister, Mike O'Grady. Like, yeah, that's a long night right there. I mean, it's pretty tough dudes rolling through Saskatoon. And, well, obviously you get traded there later, but in Brandon, of course, you had Dingman and Wade Redden. And what was it like? Well, Darren Van Owen and stuff like that, in Brandon, PA, right? You have Shane Toporowski in PA, and it just goes on and on about, you're in the East Division there, just stacked up. Overall, in your first year, how did you think it went for you?
I think it was a good learning how to play your game, and obviously in that day and age, you had to be, because you're 6'4", I think I was made, I was a bigger kid for a 6 year old. I was probably close to 195 pounds. Like most kids that are going in as a 6 year old are maybe 180, 185. So you get 10 pounds, but as you play throughout the year, you drop a little weight, right? So I think it was learning how to manage your performance, right? Like it's always, it's working with kids nowadays, with the agency thing, and, you're trying to prepare them and really tell them, like, hey, this is, you think you're working hard, but you're going to have a huge eye opening when you're going against kids that are, potentially, if you want to play as a 16 year old in the Western Hockey League, you're going to go against 19, 20 year old men, right? And you have to have that physicality maturity to your, which doesn't, it comes naturally, you can help along with working out and stuff like that. But that was the biggest thing for me, was actually knowing, like, hey, I got to really, work out and gain some strength, not so much the size, but the strength. And that was, overall, I thought it was, I didn't score any goals that year. I had 5 assists, and, I think I had 75, 80 PIMs or whatever it was. And, I obviously had probably 5-6 fights in there. So that was good for penalty minutes, in the sense of a 16-year-old, you're not taking a lot of minor penalties. Most of them were all majors. So I think it was a good learning experience for sure. Going into that 16-year-old year, we had Perry Pern as our coach. So you learn a lot from him. You knew it was a one-stop shop for him, because he was going off to the NHL the following year. So you tried to soak up as much as you can from a guy that's very intellectual with the game and teaching it. So it was a good year. It was a lot of fun as a 16-year-old. And I never did get homesick, even though I was only 5 hours away from home. But I was never one of those kids that, I don't want to be, too far from home. It just happened to be that way. I wasn't that far. Like, 5 hours isn't far. But my parents were flexible enough to come down and go on a road trip. So, like, Blair St. Martin was my roommate with my first billet. And they all, Blair's parents, my parents, and our billets came on the West Coast swing, when we went from PG down to Kamloops and then to Kelowna and then all through Tacoma. At that time it was Tacoma. First year was Tacoma. before they moved to Kelowna, and then obviously Portland. So it was fun, that and the very memorable times with able to share somewhat of the road trip with your family, but also majority of the time obviously with the team and everything else. So it was a good year.
Well, like you said, you were rooming with St. Martin there, billeting with St. Martin. Obviously, you know, going on to become a surgeon. Did you see that back in the day? Was he pretty, obviously he was, schooling was a big priority to him. What was he like? What was hanging out with him like and playing?
Blair was a great roommate, you know, very smart. And he helped me with my homework. You know, great.
Well, I was going to say, like, yeah, that's the guy you want helping you with your stuff for sure.
Yeah, like he helped me out when I asked, like, but it came natural for him. You know, like he was so, he went to school, like it was just something that boom, boom, boom just came to him. He was really, really very, very educated young guy at that time. And, you know, you try and use him as much as you can to help. You know, and I wasn't a Rhodes Scholar. I'd worked hard for, you know, 70, 75, low 80s were my highest marks. But he was, you know, he was in a whole different league than I was at that time. And, you know, he was already graduated, you know, I think a year earlier. I don't remember him, you know, doing a lot of homework. I just remember him getting a lot of good marks. So, yeah, you know, I used him a lot. And he was, in a good way, in the sense to help me out and how to study and how to do all those types of things. So it was really, really a good first roommate billet situation, as you call it. For my first year, it was a lot of fun with Blair.
No, absolutely. Well, of course, the next year, of course, this is the big year coming up here. You're coming in, you're 17, you know, you've played you got a season under your belt, you know, NHL draft, you're going to start having the scouts coming around and all that's going to start amping up. You know, like you said, 6 goals this year, 131 minutes in penalties. Was that like a conscious effort on your part to like, okay, I got to, you know, maybe step it up a little more physically? I mean, you had, you know, 5 fights and like, was that a conscious decision on your part?
Not initially. Like that summer, like I knew I had to do something different, like for, you know, obviously, you know, you want to make sure that you're going in there as prepared as you can, you know, hockey wise. So I went over to the Czech Republic and I stayed with a family in Kladno, which is obviously now, like, it was always Jaromír Jágr's hometown. Now he obviously owns the team and is still playing there, but I practiced with the pro team there for 2 weeks, did the off ice stuff with them, and I came back, and it was the 2 weeks right before I ended up going to training camp. I think I ended up being maybe a day or two behind with a couple of delays in my travel plans, but I felt way better getting into camp hockey wise. I may have not hit the gym. I did hit the gym, don't get me wrong. And training that way, but I think I paid more attention, you know, especially the 2 weeks leading up to camp was every day on the ice and really just feeling I had to get ahead of the curve, you know, instead of feeling, you know, training camp mode, your regular season mode type pace to your game. So I think that gave me a little bit of a head start, but the physicality part just came, you know. It's not like, yeah, you know, you're playing against some certain guys that, you know, you're going to have to maybe answer the bell. And, you know, you get nervous. Right? You kind of maybe get a little bit sidetracked of what you really want to do out there and just play. You have to, you know, let's just get it over and done with. Let's ask to get it. Let's go and get it done. And then you can focus on the game. So there's a few games like that for sure within that schedule that, you know, you have to take care of business first. And then you kind of let the nerves settle and just play the game.
Well, and there's a couple names that I want to ask you about, and it was obviously on your road trip out there, because it was in December 8th and then December 15th, a couple of your tilts. One, the first one in Prince George, you fought Sheldon Surrey. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I remember that one. He was a man among boys at that time. Like,
yeah.
Sheldon was always a big man, but I think he was like a freaking Greek god when you know off the ice, and, you know, obviously he was a tough customer for sure. And, you know, I just remember, you know, you just hope for the best. You know, at that point, you know, you're a younger kid that's, you know, trying to make an impression, you know, and on the scouts and saying, yeah, you know, he's a big kid that can, you know, play the game, but obviously he's not scared to to tangle up against guys that obviously that would, which would make them impress, right? You're not going against another 16 or 17 year old to really make a statement. You're going up against a guy that's obviously NHL caliber ready. At that time, he is, you know, like I said, a man among boys. So you kind of, you know, I don't know if it was planned that way. If I, you know, I don't remember exactly, but I just remember just reacting and going at it, and the rest is history after that. So you kind of, word gets around the league pretty quick. And then I think it was, you know, you're going down into Kamloops, and, you know, you're more worried about hearing that taking care of business song more so than anything, because they, you know, the team that they had down there, you know, then going into Kelowna, my second year, you have Scott Parker and Colin Fedorik. You know, it's just some you know, real ugly, not in, you know, just ugly guys that you know you're going to have to, you know, be very well aware of what you're doing on the ice.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, absolutely. And that whole, yeah, and then, you know, Portland and, you know, with Tedarenko and those guys there and Pop. And, yeah, that was a crazy scene out west there in Spokane and stuff. But, well, one of the guys, I mean, I know we talked about him off the air. Of course, he's a member of the Hockey Podcast Network. Old, what's it on Shoresy? Ted Hitchcock. Terry Ryan, who you did battle with in Tri-Cities. You two dropped the gloves. The fight is actually on YouTube, folks, if you want to check it out. And I know Terry, I mean, everybody's heard him on the podcast, and he tells all his stories, and he has his books and everything, and he's very self-deprecating, everything else. But I always try to impress upon people, though. I mean, you know, Terry will joke about it and whatever. But when he was in the Western Hockey League, him and Lankow ran show in Tri-City. Like, he was awesome. Like, 50 goals and 200 minutes and 30 fights. And what was it like playing against him? And do you have any stories of Terry Ryan?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, going into Tri-Cities, you know, that time, you only played him twice, you know, once at home and once at their barn. So, you know, the anticipation was always at a peak. It wasn't like you're playing them 6-7 times and you're kind of like, here we go again type thing. So you got up for the game, and obviously, you know, you're trying to win the game, but you're also, you know, at that time, you're trying to set a tone early on. And if games kind of got out of hand, which they very well could have, you know, playing against Tri-Cities, because they were such a formidable opponent with scoring and everything else, and they were tough. And, you know, it's just like, you know, you have it, you know, he was drafted the year before, to Montreal, first round. He made a statement for himself where he can score, fight, do everything. So you're like, all right, here we go. Right? You know, and you don't know, I didn't know him personally at that time. You know, I had friends that I grew up with that were on Tri-Cities at the time that would tell me what he was like and this and that, you know, just a crazy Newfoundlander out west, right? So it was like, you know, like he wasn't scared of anything. So you're young. You can be influenced quite easily in the sense of how your mindset goes. But yeah, it was something that we wanted to, you know, that I thought, hey, however the game went, if it presents itself, I'm going to take advantage of it and use that to benefit, you know, my stock, I guess, in my draft year, and see where it went. You know, and I think from what I can remember, it was a pretty decent fight. From what I can remember, I'd have to go back on YouTube and watch it again. But from what I remember, it was a fair tussle. But I think it was later that year, friends of mine, Mike and Mark Hurley, who played on Tri-Cities with Terry, I remember when he signed with Montreal, he bought a Trans Am. Now, I'm getting this secondhand, so after I got to know Terry on a personal level, I can see this happening. At the time, I was like, nah, you're full of shit. But it was, he bought a Trans Am at the time, and he drove it until he ran out of gas. And that was like really the first story that I heard of Terry Ryan. And like, what? Why the fuck would you not put gas in your car? He just runs it right to the ground. And, you know, like, it's never good to run in. He's probably going about, you know, $120, $130, whatever he was going, on the way back from Tri-Cities to Edmonton. I think that's where they were going to for the off season, and runs right out of gas. Like, you're like, how dumb can this guy be? You know, like, you have to put gas in it. Just because you buy the car, it doesn't mean it comes with endless gas and you don't have to put it in. So that was the first real story that I heard of TR there. But then we reconnected, obviously, through O2 Pro. We saw each other. I remember we were in Fredericton when I was playing in Providence. And I remember it was playoffs, or maybe it was just a league, regular league game up there. And we were, you know, we had some big guys, you know, and we ended up having a scrap in the hallway. The whole team, like, they had 4, 5, 6 guys in the hallway. We had, like, Joel Perfect, who was 6'7", 6'8", and he's reaching over with his stick and hitting guys in the head with his stick. And, you know, Terry's right in the middle of it too, right? So it was always an eventful time when you had Terry Ryan around. So fast forward it a little bit to about 2010-ish. He was back out in Edmonton, and he just came back from Newfoundland, and he did a TV show, because he got to a point where he was, I think, 230, 240 pounds. Don't quote me on the weight, but he was fat and out of shape. And he went on a TV show in Newfoundland, a weight loss competition, and he ended up winning it. And he was showing me this picture where you know, at some place in Edmonton, and he's like, yeah, I won this competition. Because I said, like, fuck, last time I saw you, you're terrible shape. You couldn't even probably skate or run a mile if you're, like, dependent on it. He says, yeah, you know, I got into the show and I lost all this weight, and I'm back at my fighting weight, et cetera. So what he does to celebrate, Darren, is he goes, calls the cab, and shows me this. He says, I got a cab, I get in the cab, I go down to George Street in Newfoundland, right in St. John's. And, you know, if everyone knows Newfoundland, or St. John's specifically, George Street is, you know, a place to party, and it's all pedestrian, no cars and everything else. So it's a great place to go have a beer or two. He's stark naked. He's got running shoes on. He showed me a picture on his phone. He's butt naked in the bar. Like doing the old Captain Morgan stance on the bar. I was like, you got to be shitting me. Like, who thinks of this? And obviously, only where can this ever happen? Only in Newfoundland, I guess, right? So it was like, you're just shaking your head. You're like, did I just see this? And you're like, is this photoshopped or what? But it was not. And it's like, you know what? That's Terry Ryan to a T. He does not care what other people think, and I think, you know, that's what makes him Terry Ryan.
He's a unique dude. Yeah. Anything for the story, right? Yeah. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Wow. What a character. Well, yeah, like you said, you have a solid season. As the year's going on, I mean, obviously there's scouts around, and, you know, obviously you have an agent and whatever, but, what's the word? Are they telling you, like, hey, man, you're going to be, you know, you're looking like potential first round, or, like, what were you hearing?
I was hearing, you know, late first round, early second, and obviously, you know, like, every team has their own wish list and needs and whatnot, but the teams that I talked to, they all liked my game, and obviously, I remember having an interview with San Jose, and it was down in Calgary. They had a bunch of us down in Calgary. And I remember the head scout was asking me, like, do you think you're ready to play in the NHL next year? And as an 18-year-old, I said, naive as I was at that time, I said, yeah, I think I could make a run at it. You know, knowing that I was probably a few years away. But you never know what happened. You know, have a big off season timing and all that kind of stuff. You never know. So he kind of laughed at me and said, well, we don't think you're ready. I don't personally think you're ready. And I said, yeah, fair enough. Right. So, you know, I think whoever you talk to, you know, they're all, you know, late first round, early second, you know, and obviously it just came to fruition that it was ended up, you know, I wasn't even paying attention at the draft at that time. I was sitting beside my cousin, who's a twin from New Zealand, and she was out visiting us, and she was down in St. Louis for the time, and we were just talking away, and those, you know, first 7 picks go, and then all of a sudden, you know, Boston's up, and they call my name, and I didn't even think Boston. I knew Boston had some interest. Gordy Clark was the head scout at the time, and when I was there in my last interview in St. Louis, and none of it. They had a bunch of guys in the corner there. They had maybe only 2 or 3 guys asking me questions, you know, where you kind of, you know, you're in that, you know, in those small conference rooms, and no one really seemed interested besides Gordy and a couple other guys. And it was, a, you know, 15, 20 minutes. You come out and they thank you. And then Gordy came out in the hallway and said, hey, John, and just, you know, just enjoy the rest of your night. And, you know, everything will work out tomorrow. And best of luck to you, and hope to see you soon, and this and that, right? And I was very polite. So thank you very much, Mr. Clark. I appreciate your time and this and that. And I wasn't even thinking that, because, you know, no one's really interested. No one else is really interested. So when you don't have a lot of people that are asking you questions in your interviews, you think, well, they not, you know, maybe a couple of guys are interested, but they kind of get overruled in the sense of who they want to pick. And then, yeah, then they pick. And then I was like, oh, I best said that's me. And then I get up and, you know, do the hugs to the family and handshakes and make my way down. And, I was a little bit surprised, but obviously ecstatic at the same time. But it was like, oh, geez, that's a big jump from going late first round, early second to top 10.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I mean, just to go back to Terry Ryan for a second, I mean, obviously he tells the famous draft story interview with him and Mike Milbury. Did you have anything, I don't know if you've heard it, but him and Milbury kind of got into it and whatever, and he was kind of smarted off to him or whatever. But like, did you have any like really weird interviews or like somebody kind of just do some weird shit? Like, or was it all pretty straightforward?
Actually, my one for my draft year, it was fine. Like, I didn't have any weird ones. I know LA, there's a lot of chaos going on, and I'm trying to remember who it was. Tim Taylor. I know. Was it Taylor? He's the GM at the time, or assistant GM at the time.
Dave Taylor?
Dave Taylor, thank you, yes. And he's like, I can't remember what was going on. A lot of chaos going on in there. He said, I feel, you know, this young gentleman's here. Like, we got this shit going on. Like, what are we doing here? We're like, looks like we're a bunch of, you know, Mickey Mouse, this bullshit around here. Yeah, we're from LA, but we're not Mickey Mouse's or whatever the comment was, right? And that was really the only one off. But the one that I had that was really strange is the year before, it was in Edmonton. And obviously, my agent was local to Edmonton, and his clients that he had coming in were, you know, some Czech players, Slovak players, and this and that. And I ended up, he asked if I could help out with getting them there to their interviews. So I remember taking Peter Sikora, Pavel Trinka, Yogi Slavkovsky was around there as well. And I remember going to the Fairmont Hotel McDonald in Edmonton, and I remember going up the stairs and, you know, just waiting for the guys and showing them where to go or whatever. And I can't remember exactly the team. It could have been Washington, but don't quote me on it. But I go in there, they say, yeah, we know who you are, come on in. And I'm sitting here and I just got my shorts and t-shirt on, and this older guy is like rubbing my shoulders, right, as he's standing behind me and I'm sitting in this chair. And he's, you know, he's like, you know, you give your wife a massage on the shoulders and the neck and everything else. And I'm like, this is kind of weird. What's this guy doing? I think he's just an old pervert or whatever, right? And it's like, this guy's going to be, he's going to fill out real nice, right? And he does that, and then he walks away. I'm like, all right, thanks. I didn't know you were able to see how I'm going to fill out in 3-4 years by rubbing my shoulders and my neck. So that was the odd time that I remember any type of interview, but it wasn't even my interview, to be honest with you.
Well, you go eighth overall to the Bruins. So of course, you know, we head into the fall. I mean, I'm assuming you obviously went to Bruins camp. How was that? I mean, to go into that setting with, Steve Kasper's the coach at the time, but just to be in an NHL camp, like and sitting in that locker room, that's got to be surreal.
Yeah, no, it was, I remember that first camp, and I was having a good camp. You know, I would just remember a pivotal moment in an exhibition game against Pittsburgh in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I remember, I don't know who the guy was, but he was a big guy. He's maybe, you know, he's obviously, he was older than I was. He was probably mid-20s or whatever, big guy. And, you know, back, you know, we're always, in juniors, you're always taking your helmets off to square off. So, you know, I'm having a game, moving the puck well, I feel pretty good. And then all of a sudden, I think I was in the second period. This guy taps me on the, he said, let's fucking go. I'm like, yeah, all right, here we go. So then I take my lid off. I back off and take my lid off, drop the gloves, take my lid off. And the guy's looking at me like, what's this fucking guy doing, right? And he kind of looked at me and looked around and like, all right. And then he paused a couple seconds, takes the helmet off. And we get in there and nothing really comes of it. It was kind of a shit fight, to be honest with you. And I remember in between periods, going into the third period, I remember Adam Oates was saying, hey, kid, yeah, keep the helmet on. These guys hit too hard if you take your helmet off. So I never took my helmet off when I screwed up. Obviously, you didn't have a visor on at the time either, so you just kept your helmet on and just went at it that way. So that's I think that was a pivotal moment in my first camp as a rookie, my first camp ever. And I think that could have been, if I had a good fight, as maybe a small detail as it was, I think it could have made a bigger impression. I think I could have stayed a little bit longer with Boston, and who knows? You know, who knows what could have happened after that? But I think that was a very pivotal moment in my training camp, my first camp. My second camp, it was, you know, I remember in practice, the pivotal moment where it was Adam Oates was in front of that, and I'm, you know, kind of boxing him out a bit. And I remember Pat Burns, obviously, was the head coach that year. He's standing up with Mike O'Connell and Harry Sinden and the coaching staff kind of at that end. And I remember Oates turns around and fucking two hands me in the shin pads. Like, not the back leg, right in my shin pads. So it didn't hurt. But it was just the motion of him doing that. And I didn't do anything. I'm like, well, this is Adam Oates. You know, he's an all-star, you know, going to be a future Hockey Hall of Famer. And what am I going to do to this guy? He doesn't fight. He doesn't do anything. So I just let it happen. I didn't do anything. And I think that was two pivotal points in my first two camps where I was like, I should have, regardless of who it was, Adam Oates or Jason Allison or Anson Carter at that time, you know, they were all there. It's like, you can't let these guys take advantage of you, regardless if, you know, because at some point in time they were in your position and they would have done, you know, if a vet did that to them, they would have done something and stood up for themselves, right? So, you know, knowing what I know now, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. But yeah, like that first year, like you said, you're there with Oates and like Ray Bourque and Rick Tocchet and Odgers and Chenault and all these guys. In your defense, did you get to spend a lot of time with Bourque? Did he talk to you, or did he, you're the rookies and he's the vet? And like, did any of the guys big league you, or were they all pretty cool with you?
No, I think Jason Allison, you know, after the year he was, you know, kind of talky, you know, driving the Ferrari into camp and this and that, right? So he never really gave the rookies or the guys a really time of day.
You know what's funny? You're the second person on this show that has said that. I'm trying to think who the other guy was, and he didn't like Allison. He was like, he's a goof. You know, I can't, who was it now? Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Obviously he had a real good year, you know, before the trade from Washington. And, but yeah, it was what it is. He was like fucking arrogant guy, whatever. But, you know, he got what he got. And, in the sense of reward for how well he played leading up to that contract. But leading up to I'm getting the shuttle from Logan Airport to our hotel for training camp. And one of the scouts, he's the Western scout for Boston. He's like, yeah, guess who your roommate is? I'm like, well, I have no idea. He says, Ray Bourque. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. Right? Like, but there I am thinking that I'm going to be sharing a room with Ray Bourque. Right. And, lo and behold, he doesn't stay at the hotel. He stays at home and everything else, right, with his family and everything else. But he did call me, over the first course of the first couple of weeks of training camp, probably 6-7 times, checking in. Hey, how you doing? Just making sure you need me to come and tuck you in, kind of being funny about it, but also, like, just being sincere and asking, hey, are you doing all right, kid, and this and that. And so that felt really cool to have him call the hotel and checking in on you type thing. Right. So, but the bonus was I had the room to myself. And then I know Rick Tocchet was really good. I remember we went out, Ray Bourque took us all out for three or four of us out for lunch after practice one day. And, I remember Tocchet came and these guys are driving their cars and, you know, I know, Bourque was all about the BMWs at the time and, maybe he still is, but yeah, he was a class act, you know, like he was just a class act. And, Jeff Odgers, obviously, you know, I don't have to tell you what kind of guy he is, a stand up guy, great teammate. From what I can remember, of them for that short period of time that we spent together. But yeah, out of them all, like, I know the young guys that were coming in their prime, like the Allison and Hanson Carters and all that kind of stuff, they were a little more, you know, who are you type guy. You haven't made it, so we're not going to talk to you type thing, right? So, which I'm sure things changed for them as they got older and more mature in their careers as well.
Yeah. Well, so you have your first camp. You go back to junior, but you don't go to Medicine Hat. You go to Brandon. What happened there? Did you ask to get traded, or what? How'd you end up with the Wheat Kings?
Yeah, it was going back. So obviously, we had my first year. We had Perry and two assistants with Perry. They all got, well, obviously Perry moved on to pro, and the other two never came. They never renewed contracts, and then he brought in Brad McEwen, who we thought at the time was, you know, yeah, he's stuck. And it was like a real step down from Perry Pern at that time. And two local guys came in as assistant coaches. They were all fired by Christmas time. And then we had Joe Canale, French guy. In that time, when they hired him, he became the very first coach to coach in all three major junior leagues. So he was a one-man show, no assistants from what I can remember. It was just him for the rest of the year, and it was just a shit show from what I can remember. So I kind of asked for the trade during the summertime before I headed into camp, and I remember it was between Brandon and Spokane at the time, and lo and behold, Mike Babcock was the head coach in Spokane at the time. And they were hosting the Memorial Cup the following year, if I remember correctly. And I was kind of hoping, you know, Spokane, Washington, or Brandon, Manitoba. I'm like, I'd like to go down to Spokane, you know, obviously playing a couple years in the Eastern Conference. You're like, oh, it's changed up. You know, the West is, you know, BC, Northwest, USA, and all that kind of stuff. A little bit nicer scenery, right? But,
yeah.
No, I get traded to Brandon and Bobby, and it was probably the best thing for me hockey wise going there with Bobby Lowe's and Kelly McCrimmon and the team that we had there, Peter Schaefer, Darren Van Owen, Dorian Anik, Justin Kurtz. You know, we had a real good team that year, and I think we finished first in the conference. We dominated. Obviously we fell into against Moose Jaw that first round of playoffs and outshot them. I don't know how many shots. Like, we had over 70 shots for the six games we played. And Donovan Nunweiler was the guy that was their goalie, and he ended up standing on his head for six games, and they beat us 4-2. But they're like close games, 2-1, 3-2, 4-2, something like that, from what I can remember. But yeah, Brandon was Bobby Lowe's was really good for me as a coach in my development, and obviously Krimmer was a big part of that as well.
Yeah, well, I know that season, you know, you ramped it up, 200 minutes of penalties, you had 12 tilts, you know, you guys are rolling. I just got to ask you about a couple guys in the team. Well, one guy I've got to ask you about, and of course he's friend of the show, and old Les Borsheim, and yeah. He was the cat that I got a hold of. I told him you were coming on the show, and he was just like, "Oh man, he played a mean game, fought some big boys." He goes, "I remember cruising around Brandon in a Porsche. I probably played some of my best hockey with him as a D partner in '98 when we went to the championship finals. We were on the ice against Hossa, who was the best player I ever played against. But we lost four straight, but I'm looking forward to hearing from Jonathan on your show." So, yeah, old Les Borsheim. What was it like playing with Big Les?
He was a class, you know, he was just a guy that just had no fear. You know, like, I honestly believe that, like, Les didn't, you know, he reacted instead of thinking about things or something. And trust me, in that part of the game, that's probably the best thing to have, where you just don't think, you just go and get after it. But Les was a lot more talented than I think a lot of people realize. The guy could skate really well. He may not have been flashy, but he could skate and make passes, and he could hit like a truck. And he was built like a brick shit house as well. Like, he was, you know, no neck Les. You know, I was a few times I told him that, right? He was such a, you know, he was big into the gym and everything else. But yeah, I remember, you know, we were against that Hossa line, and Robinson was the centerman on that line. I can't remember I'd have to look back at whoever the third guy was on that line. But yeah, Losey put a lot of a lot of onus on us, so to speak. We have to be really hard on these guys. Take, you know, be fucking mean and tough, and, you know, like, obviously being in the championship against them, you know, we bust it out. Like, I know it was between Spokane, with them hosting it, they're in game 7 against Portland in the Western Conference, so we're busting it from Brandon, and we're, all of us are like, fuck, come on Spokane, and they're in overtime in game 7, and obviously we got word we're, you know, playing Portland. Obviously they won it in overtime, and we're like, mother, you know, we're just like, this sucks, you know, busting it however many hours it is out to Spokane, and continued on to Portland, and got shit kicked. You know, I ended up having a bunch of fights that game too. You know, myself and Les, I think we had a line brawl as well. And, you know, I can't remember who was all out there for Portland, but yeah, it was, you know, obviously you had your Tedarenkos, and Andrew Ferentz was, you know, on that team as well. And, you know, I'm trying to think of the other forwards that we would have been touched with, but
yeah, the other guy on that line that you were trying to think of, Brendan Morrow,
yeah, and Morrow, obviously, you know, he was like, he had a long career in the NHL, and he played tough as well. He wouldn't back down either. So, you know, it was, but then we fly back. We play two games, you're down 2-0, and we fly back. It's like, we bus it out there. Why didn't we fly it out in the first place and rent the bus from Spokane or whatever? We did everything ass backwards at that point. We're like, so all of us, like, why are we flying back when we bus it out? We should have flew out and fly back. But we tried to extend it a bit. Was it a 4-game sweep? I thought we maybe got one out of the 3 games at home, but I could be wrong on that. I'd have to look that up again. But yeah, Les was, he was a guy that came out of really nowhere in training camp that year that he came in to play with us, and he just ended up, he was playing forward at first, and then they transitioned him back to defense and with me, and we created some havoc for sure. You know, but we could also play the game too. Right? Like, so we were, you know, you kind of thought we were, you know, the Chris Prongers of Brandon, in the sense of they didn't know what we were going to do, if we're going to slash him, cross check him, fight him, or beat him, you know, with our skating at the same time. So it was, Les was a good time playing with Les for sure.
No, absolutely, and Yeah, less a good dude. I have to get him back on the show. But I was looking at your fight card here. You had 12 tilts that one year, and Ryan Anders. You guys had a little feud going. You fought him 3 times.
No, I remember that. I don't. You know, you don't know why. I think, you know, it's not like it was planned. You know, but I think it just happened to be that way. Maybe he just hated me so much that he wanted to, you know, pump me full of, you know, fists or whatever. Who knows, right? But I think you kind of grow that hate no matter what. You know, but you also, you know, at the same time, you're like, yeah, like, you know, that was a good fight, you know, good job. And but yeah, I still fucking hate you.
So. Yeah. Well, I guess before we get into your final year, and you played the 2 seasons in Brandon, I guess, but we're kind of jumping ahead with all that. But obviously, you go into Bruins camp, your second Bruins camp. I would assume a little more confidence and stuff. But now, like you said, you know, Casper was the coach the first year. Now Pat Burns is the coach the second year. Did you have any? Because yeah, I mean, you're the first round pick. You're coming in 19. What's your relationship with Burns? Did he talk to you a lot, or was it like, what was he like? Because I mean, you hear the stories and everything, but what was it like playing for the late Pat Burns?
The first ever words that he gave me. So we're at the practice rink. He's having a meeting in the dressing room, and you know, like back in the day, you know, if you're not in the main dressing room, right? So they had the main dressing room, and then they had underneath the stands in their old practice rink. They'd have a bunch of stalls. Like they weren't cheap stalls. They were just the same as the ones that were in the main dressing room, but you're out of the main dressing room. You knew you were on an uphill battle to really make an impression and stick with the team as an 18, 19, 20 year old at that time. So So he brings everyone in and has a meeting before everything gets kind of going in camp. And it was, I don't know, 8 o'clock, you know, you get up, you know, you catch the bus. And I had long hair, like long hair as not, like not the mullet long, but I had like, poof, my hair was curly. So when I grew it, if I didn't shower or wet it, it would just be an afro, like a Mike Commodore hair.
Yeah.
Except not red. And so here I am sitting there, take my hat off, because you're taught as a kid to take your hat off when you're inside. So I took my hat off, and that was a mistake. I remember him walking around talking this thing, and he looks at me and says, "What the fuck, Aiken?" He's just like, yeah, coach, yeah, what's up? He says, "Did you have a fight with your pillow last night?" I'm like, "What?" I'm like, I'm totally lost. I'm like, "What?" He says, "Well, it looks like your pillow won." You know, everyone's laughing. I'm like, what's this guy getting on? Because my hair was a freaking disaster. So that was my first interaction with Pat Burns at that camp. So I'm like, oh, I'm leaving a good impression on this guy. I didn't even look like I put myself together before coming to the rink and this and that. So that was my first interaction with the late, great Pat Burns. So you made everyone laugh at my expense.
Well, that year, that, of course, is the big draft year when they take Samsonov and Thornton in the first round. Yeah. What was your – did you have any interaction with Thornton and Samsonov?
I was down in Boston for two summers down there training with Mike Boyle down at, you know, who was their strength and conditioning guy there.
Yep.
For a number of years. And so when the draft – that 96 or 97 draft came, I was already down in Boston training, and they were putting us up in a house in Newton, Massachusetts. There's going to be a few of us, and Joe was going to be one of them. So they did a big press conference as they came in and introduced Joe and Sergey to the media in Boston. And I was there at the press conference. I wasn't on the stage, but Harry was like, "Yeah, we got the, you know, our first two rounders here, Joe Thornton, obviously in our number one pick, the number one pick, and Sergey Samsonov, our number eight pick. And then we also have our 96 first round pick, Jonathan Aiken, standing in here as well. So we just want to, you know," so we had a big press conference and everything else that summer. Obviously everyone's, you know, seeing Joe walking down the street, and Boston is such a great city. They're like, "All the way, Joe, take us all the way." Right. And you're standing like, you're a psychic, because everyone, you know, is all about Joe Thornton, which rightfully so. They rented us a house. So there was a guy named Joe Curran, who is Harry Sinden's right-hand man. He'd do everything. He'd be a chauffeur. He'd be essentially, he did whatever whatever Harry wanted him to do. Like nothing to do with hockey operations or anything. Just kind of be his mate, in a sense, and chauffeur.
Yeah, but he was such the a gopher. Guy. Yeah.
And so they rent this house in Newton, Massachusetts for myself, Joe when he was in town, if he wasn't back in Ontario, John Graham, Cameron Mann, Randy Robitaille. I think there's the five of us, maybe one other guy, Elias Abrahamson, big Swedish guy. Swedish, he's not blonde, he's brown as, brown hair as can be. We stayed in that house for the summer. And we trained, and Joe was our chef, essentially. He came in, he had like Thanksgiving dinners every night for, you know, every day of the week. And then obviously we'd go out, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights on the town and had our fun that way. But yeah, the interaction with Joe and more so Joe than Sergey. Sergey kind of went back. I don't know if he went back to Russia or he went back to Michigan or wherever he was at that time. It was an eventful summer. That summer, for sure, was very eventful, for sure.
Well, and in that camp, how did you get into any preseason games at all? The second
year? I got into preseason games. Yeah, I played two or three exhibition games that year before they sent me back for my before, I guess, going down to, well, I would have been 20, I guess, if I'm going into my, but we're talking about going into my third. I went down to Providence. It wasn't the first set of cuts. I think it was the second round of guys that they either sent down to Providence or got guys back to juniors or whatever. So, yeah, it was, you know, at that time you're like, fuck, third time, it's not looking too good. But, you know, you're going into a very good year, like, we ended up, you know, in the American League with Peter Laviolette being our head coach in Providence. Bill Armstrong was our player assistant at that time. That was the player part was really short-lived for Army. Yeah, I think he only played maybe three games, and then he, I'm done. And he became the full-time assistant behind the bench. And we ended up winning, like, including playoffs, I think we won 75 games that year. So as a rookie, you got a lot, you know, you got a good experience. And obviously we had a more successful season that year than the parent team did in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, you guys win the Calder, and, I mean, you know, first-year pro, and you're winning the Calder, you're probably, oh, that's pretty easy. I mean, a couple character. I mean, you had Terry Virtue on the team, but one of the guys that comes across, I mean, I've never talked to him, but he comes across like quite the character. And, of course, he picked up 400 minutes in penalties that year was Aaron Downey. Do you got any Downey stories?
Oh, Downs is one of the, you know, he's such a, you know when you talk about guys, like, that just know their role and just play it to a role, but they're such a good dressing room guy. Downs would have like his shirt on. You'd roll a towel and put it under his shirt around his neck, and he'd be doing fucking squats and hang cleans and jerks and all this stuff before the warm up in game. 'Cause he knew he was only going to be playing 2-3 minutes or whatever, but he ended up getting more and more minutes as the year went on just because he became such a, you know, a moment, he was able to swing momentum in our favor if we needed it. But I can, he'd always talk about how he had his class on, because big potato farmers, right? Yep. His family had a big potato farm in Ontario. I'm sure maybe they still have it. I'm not too sure, but he's just a hardworking guy. And, you know, he'd always, you know, after a night out, you know, if we're a little bit hungover, he got me onto the sauna cold tub routine, right? Go in the sauna, get it right hot. Like, if you come in maybe a couple hours before practice, if we were able to make it that early before practice and really wake ourselves up from being hungover, and do the sauna and then dump ourselves into the cold tub as cold as you can, getting a little shock therapy. So that's one thing that I learned from Downs, is how to take care of yourself body-wise, even if you go out. And he'd always say, you work hard, you party, heart aches. That's kind of what he said. That was his motto. So yeah, he's a great guy. You know, that's one guy that I've tried to get a hold of in the past few years, and you're trying to get contact information and stuff. So just to kind of catch up and see where he's at and how he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another tough guy that was on your team, he played just the 29 games, but the big man, Roger Maxwell. Do you remember him?
Mm. Yeah, well, Roger Dodger, yeah, he was, again, all these guys, you know, great teammates. Roger, you know, I remember him the first game, or within the first couple of games, we were down in New Haven, Connecticut, and if you've ever been down in New Haven, it's a shithole. You know, it's downtown especially. It was a bit of sketchy, but it was a New Haven Beast. So I think that was Florida's farm team, I think, at that time.
Yes, it was.
And Peter Worrell was in the lineup for them as well. And Roger's like, yeah, I got to, you know, obviously he said his few choice words, I'm going to beat up this guy, and you watch me do this, I'm going to do it. And, you know, he got called up, you know, maybe a few days before that, but he had that probably marked in his calendar, knowing that he was coming up. And I remember these two guys just keying off on each other. And it was like a bare knuckle event in a sense, because it's like, the buildings aren't like what they are now, right? You know, very dungy, made of brick or cement or whatever, and it was a very dungy arena from what I can remember in New Haven. And they had the worst jerseys ever as well. Like, yeah, they had fluorescent green gremlin on it. It was awful. But man, yeah, they had some, obviously Worrell was on the lineup there, and they had some bunch of tough guys in there, right? Anywhere you went at
yeah.
that time in those late, very late, 98, 99 was my first year. So late 90s, early 2000s, up to like probably 2005, 2004, it was, no matter where you went, you had to have your A game going on, because if you got caught sleeping, you're a hurting unit for sure the next day.
Well, one fight you had that year was actually your last fight that season, was in the playoffs against Hartford, against PJ Stock. How did that fight go?
A couple lefties, that's for sure. I remember, you know, like I think I made a surprise stalker with me able to throw less, because I ended up, you know, even though I am a righty, I started throwing less because I did take some boxing. That's one thing I did take from Rocky, and did some summer training in Edmonton at the Panther Gym with Kenny LaCosta and Daryl Duke, who passed away. But he ended up becoming the Oilers. In the probably mid early 2000, Daryl became their head strength guy. But yeah, he taught me how to throw my left. So in that fight, I think it was a pretty good fight. Like, he just, it looks really good on tape for him, in a sense. But I think you can throw a few pillows in there as well. But obviously you're in right and tight there. You're fighting for, you know, to play, because I know we had some injuries and that was able to get me into the lineup and play the rest of the playoffs and against Rochester and everything else. So it was a pivotal moment in the playoffs for me to stay in the lineup as a rookie.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Old PJ Stock. Yeah. He's something to watch fight. That's for sure. Yeah. I noticed that actually, cause I was watching your fights before I was getting ready for the interview. And yeah, I noticed that early on you were throwing the rights, but I saw you got the lefts going, and, actually your fight, well, we'll get into it in the NHL with Steve McLaren, you had the lefts going pretty good. But yeah, so obviously you could throw both hands. So that's kind of figured you must have done some boxing, but so 99-2000, you get into three games with the Bruins. Going into that year, you go back to Providence for the, you know, you played 70 games with Providence. Was that, you know, like you said, first round pick, third year, was it pretty disappointing to not make the team? Well, I mean, that's a stupid question. I mean, obviously you're there to make the team, but I guess frustration, is that more, like, were you kind of like, what are we doing here? Like, I got to make it. Like, what was their talk to you? Like, what were they saying was basically holding you back from not making the team?
From what I can remember, Darren, there wasn't a whole lot of talk. It was just, yeah, they were sending you to the province.
Yeah.
That was it. You know, it wasn't really, I think the way that the development is now, back then, I think it's a whole different game now.
Yeah.
I think Detroit would have been the very first team that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, that really took development seriously, and then they'd be upfront with their guys. You know, you're going to play 3 years in Grand Rapids or whatever, you know, wherever their farm team is. I know it's still in Grand Rapids, but it's like whatever team. I know they were really patient with their young prospects, and obviously, yeah, you have your one-offs that come in and play right away. Like obviously in '95, they drafted Kyle McLaren, who was very similar. Him and I were very similar players.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, for whatever reason, you know, did I work hard enough? I thought I worked hard. Could I have worked harder? Probably. But at the end of the day, I do think, you know, you need to have someone in there that can really push. And then, because Doherty Clark was the guy that essentially drafted me in '96. And then he left that summer to go with the Islanders. So I don't know if I really had anyone really advocating for me within the organization that had some weight behind their decisions or their recommendations, especially when Burns came in, right? Like, I don't know if there was really anyone that really told him what he wanted for a lineup or to give opportunities for, right? So he comes in, he's got Joel Thornton, Sergei Samsonov as their first ever draft picks under his coaching regime, right? So I came in a year before, which was kind of a shit year for them, you know, getting rid of Casper and this and that. And so it was definitely frustrating. I never did, from what I can remember, really got told what I needed to, besides me thinking, well, I got to get better, but what do I have to get better at in a sense? Right. So, besides the usual bigger, faster, stronger type stuff. Right. And, it was disappointing for sure. And I remember within the first, maybe week of practices down in Providence in the regular season, it was past preseason and stuff. I remember we're doing a drill and Bill Army was dressed in his hockey equipment practicing with us. And I remember we did this. I was the first guy to go in this one drill and I was doing the drill. I knew what the drill was. I ended up doing it. And then I fucking caught one of my teammates, Jay Henderson, who I grew up with a little bit as well, behind me. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like thinking to myself, what are you doing, Hendy? Right? Like, you're fucking up my drill here. And I kind of laid up. I stopped skating. And I'm Army's like, fuck, Aiken, get your fucking ass moving. Stop being so lazy. That it just made an ass out of me in front of everyone. And I'm like, well, what the, like, what am I standing here? I'm like, why is Hendy following me? He's not supposed to be coming. And then he was just skating because he had his, an injury on his arm or his hand or something. So he was only out there skating. But he came, he was following guys in drills, but that was the first drill that we were doing, and I had no idea what he was doing, so it caught me off guard. And I remember Army at the end of that practice said, you know, he went up one side, down the other. In a way, back then, I was like, this guy's just giving me shit because whatever. But, you know, you look back at it now, it's like he's being honest, and maybe the way he approached it could have been a little, or how he delivered it could have been a little more delicate, but... You know, he said, you got this window's closing already for you. You know, you think you're a first round draft pick, you everything should be given to you and this and that. And it was a big wake up call, but I was also a little bit confused. I'm like, well, fuck, it was one drill. It's not like I didn't work hard in practice, you know, so that was topping it all off from the disappointment of not making it in my third camp as a 20-year-old, you know, thinking that you're doing everything you can in the summertime to do that.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, and it's like I said, that season you get up to the show in April, and I looked it up. April 5th in Florida was your NHL regular season debut, and there's the pinnacle, man. You made it to the top of the mountain. What's it like to strap it on and play your first regular season NHL game? Like what was that feeling like?
It was amazing. I flew down from Providence with Peter Ferraro. He was called up at the same time, and we flew down together to Florida. Obviously, we got there a little bit earlier before everyone else at the rink. And obviously, you know, it's Florida at that time. You know, they were getting, you know, okay crowds, I guess. It was kind of, you know, maybe after their, you know, the run that they made to the Stanley Cup final, it was kind of tailing off by that time, but still an NHL arena with all the perks that you get when you're a player, right. In the dress room and just the massive size of the stands. It was an incredible feeling to step up on there. And they never did the rookie lap back then. You just went out and that was it. Right. So, It was a moment you'll never forget for sure. And then I remember playing, you know, going on the plane, and you know, you're like getting dinners served to you and everything else, and it's like this is the life. This is awesome. And you're like you're just trying to soak it all in. You know, you got Ray Bourque on the plane, you got, you know, Adam Oates, you got all these guys on the plane, and you know PJ Axelson was there as well. It was a great Bruin. And yeah, then you go in and you play Pittsburgh, the Knicks. I think that was the Knicks, or maybe that was our last game that we played.
No, you played Philadelphia, Lindros and them,
Philly.
Yeah,
and you know, you're like, yeah, that was a night and day when you play Florida and you come up and you play Philadelphia and you're in their barn too, right? So it was surreal. It really was. You see these guys on TV, John LeClaire. I was up at John LeClaire's golf tournament in New Hampshire in one of the, before everyone kind of came down in the summer of 98. And I bought the auction. There was three sticks, to, you know, obviously their line, the Legion of Doom, with Lindros, Renberg, and John LeClaire. So I put a bid on these three sticks. And I won the three sticks. So I'm like, and I was pissed off when I saw them, because I'm like, and I forgot about it at that time, because when I went down to Providence when I got sent down to Providence at training camp, I put those three sticks in the bus that was going down to Providence's rink. And between there and me going to the rink and grabbing those sticks, someone stole those sticks, those three of them. And I still to this day think it was our trainer. He's with Vinny, what the hell's Vinny's last name? He's in the NHL. I'm trying to think who he is. He's with San Jose. Vinny, small little Italian guy. Nice guy, but he was just kind of breaking in because he came in from Wheeling with Lavie, Peter Laviolette, from Wheeling in the East Coast League. And to this day, I was like, how do these sticks get lost? Like, I put them on the bus because I couldn't fit them in my car because I already had enough stuff in it. And I said, I'll just go down to Providence. It's a 30-minute drive, whatever it is, from Boston, and couldn't find them. So kicking myself in the ass after we're back on the plane heading back to Boston, and I'm like, fuck, I should have got them to sign their sticks again. I could have made it, still had that souvenir. But, yeah, you know, it's a whole different life. The lifestyle in the NHL is way different than, you know, obviously the American League. You know, it's night and day. And right from how you can yourself to even when you are looking to fight, like these guys are men, right? Like you don't realize it until you're actually on the ice. Like you think they're big, they're even bigger in person, but you tend to forget how they look at you. You know, a big young guy, but you don't see yourself that way. You just see everything else, and that's kind of was my maybe my downfall to really make that statement. Like these guys see you as a big young guy coming in there trying to make a name for yourself. But you never did because you looked at them in a different, whole different light, and a little bit. Not that you didn't respect them, you just gave them too much respect without, you know, being hard on them. And you know what? If you had to end up, you know, fighting, you know, Chris McAllister or someone, you know, within that, any tough guy going through it as well. It's I'm just thinking Chris because I think he was in Philadelphia at that time as well or thereabouts. So
it was a whole.
Yeah, those three games we'll never forget. Never forget those three games, especially with the team that drafted you.
Yeah. Well, and another guy, before we just get away from the Bruins, that was on that team that year was McSorley. Did you spend any time with Marty?
Just in the dressing room at the time that we were there. Nothing memorable to the point of having a conversation with him or any of that, but, you know, he was a very jovial guy in the dressing room from what I can remember, you know, smile on his face. And, you know, he was one of those guys. He knew what his role was and he worked his ass off every day to keep that role, you know, but he was really good in the dressing room. He was nice to everyone, not just to vets or anything like that. He was nice to everyone.
Well, you said and then the final game there with Pittsburgh, of course they have Yager and stuff, but another guy that hit with Barnaby. Did you have any? Do you remember playing against Barnaby?
Yeah, I do. You know, you don't forget those types of players. No. They're very animated, very least, right? So, these are things that, you know, when you're bringing these names back up, and obviously the time frame that I was, you know, you remember all these memories coming back a lot more clearer than, you know, if I was trying to think about it last week, even. You know, so it's, it was, you know, fucking chatting away, just lipping the fuck. This guy never shuts up. and you can understand, like, how, you know, if you know, obviously, you know, when you're playing these guys so many times during the year, you know, you know you're going to, fuck, I just want to shut this guy up because it's constant. It was just constant time. And that was only one game. You know, like, imagine you're playing at that time, I think they're playing at least six times against those types of, you know, in those conferences, right? Or in your division.
Yeah.
So it was, you can see how those rivalries and the animosity that you just can't stand certain guys.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're playing, you don't know them outside of the rink.
No, absolutely.
And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Football is back in full swing with another week of epic games. And who's got you covered on the action for every single one of them? DraftKings Sportsbook, the official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers can bet $5 on football and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Nobody's missing out on the action this season. All DraftKings customers can take advantage of two new offers every game day this September. Get in on the NFL Week 2 action with DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the app now and use the code THPN to sign up. New customers can bet just $5 and take home $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with the code THPN. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.sot1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of the Boot Hill Casino and Resorts in Kansas City, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/football terms for eligibility, terms, and responsible gambling resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Eligibility and deposit restrictions apply.
And now back to your regularly scheduled program.
All right, folks, we're back here. I just wanted to save that part. All right, well, so you play the three games with the Bruins, you wrap up. And the next, obviously, was it, a mutual parting of the ways, or did they just, what happened there? Because actually the next season, you start in the Czech Republic. What happened with the whole Boston Bruins situation?
Yeah, it was, again, you know, getting sent down to Providence, and obviously when I got down there, you know, you get your rings, you start off the season quite well. You get your rings from winning the championship your first year. Your last year of contract, you're looking for a big year. And, you know, and it's back then, it's like, well, how can you, it's a demotion if you end up playing forward as a defenseman. You know, you're not playing top six lines, or you're playing fourth line. Obviously, I was very, you know, I was pissed off and whatever else. And my agent didn't do me any favors, I don't think, at the time. You know, it could have said, like, you know what, you're going to have to grin and bear it and keep working hard and don't lose focus. But you need, it was just be somewhere else. And they weren't able to trade me anywhere. I don't know if they even tried to trade me. So it was, that part of it was very, very discouraging, Darren, to say the least. So, then he ended up saying, well, we can get you over to Slovakia. Actually, it was, the first team was in Slovakia, in Trenčín, you know, old Zdeno Chara's nick of the woods. And do I still have you?
Yeah, yeah. You're kind of going in and out a little bit, but no, I got you.
I was in Slovakia and in Trenčín. So I was going over there pretty miserable, pissed off on different levels. One with my agent, one with myself. And it was just, it was just disappointing all around. And then I ended up playing a few practices over in Trenčín with the team there, and then they ended up, I was there for maybe a week, then I ended up going to Prague, and I kind of finished the year in Prague, which was a lot of fun, don't get me wrong. It was more fun than it was worried about developing as a hockey player, that's for sure. But when you're able to go buy a beer for a big pint of beer, and it's good beer over there for sure, for 80 cents American, you tend to focus more on that, right?
Yeah.
And there, it was a wake up call really over there, like how, like, it was just a lifestyle for them. Like all the guys that were on the team, like Peter Nedved's brother was on the team. He was my D partner. And I remember after my first game, there's these, beautiful Czech women coming in with platters of food, and they're dressed in these skin tight body suits. And it was like, what's going on here? And it's like, I can get used to this, right? And yeah, it was, and then these guys are doing like moonshine shots before they go out for the game. Like, it's not like they're getting drunk or anything like that. They just take a big, like a shot glass, or, half a smaller glass shot of this homemade liquor. And they, not everyone did it, but probably a good handful of guys would do it. And you're like, geez, like, this is a whole different world when it came to their preparation and how they played the game. So it was different for sure, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was just how I came about. You know, you think you'd play over in Europe at the end of your career, not kind of at this, you know, within the first 3 years of your pro career.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I know I had a lot to do with it, obviously, because it was my career. I had control of what I could do, but I never did stand up to what I needed to do, you know, for myself, either be with my agent or with Boston and say, you know what, I gotta bring it more. I had to, you know, if I had to fight more, I should have fought more. If I had to play harder, if I had to, you know, play a different style of game, work on doing that. And I guess I was, you know, going back to the Bill Armstrong comment of your window being so small, you know, I never took advantage of it.
Yep.
So that's kind of where I ended up at that time. And obviously, you know, down the line, you get a second run at it, and you made more of an opportunity out of that second opportunity.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so the next year you come back to North America and you actually start in the East Coast League in Jackson with the Bandits. And, at that point, I mean, you're trying to make the comeback in North America and get your name back out there. How did you take the East Coast League? Were you pretty miserable there, or did you understand that this is the step you needed to take? Or
yeah, yes and no. Like, I think when you looked at that back in the time, like, I know nowadays it's a lot different than how I'm looking at it nowadays, you know, being in, you know, trying to make it as an agent with young players and everything else, you see it in a different light as you right now, because you obviously going through it is one thing, but then seeing it from a different point of view, you know, I think back then it was like all the East Coast. If you play in the East Coast, you're done.
Yeah,
and then probably at that time 98% you are done.
Yeah,
you know, but obviously there's a few guys that came out of that, you know, around that, you know, especially in the late 90s, early 2000, there wasn't very many of them that would, you know, go on and make an NHL career out of it. There are exceptions, don't get me wrong, that did do that. But I'm like, fuck, I'm 23, I think, at that time. And I'm like, in the East Coast League, I'm like, just 4 or 5 years ago, I'm a first-round draft pick. And I'm like, where did this all go wrong, in a sense? I'm like, what am I missing? What am I not doing? What do I need to do? So I need it, you know, and then, yeah, Jackson was okay. It was like, it was a different, total different life being in Mississippi for sure. It's like, and some of the guys that you're on the team, you're like, what the fuck are you thinking? Like, you guys are, you know, it wasn't very good hockey, right? So you're like, you don't want to get sucked in and playing shit hockey for, you know, 2-3 months and then you never get back to the American League. Don't even think about the NHL at that time, right? So I was very fortunate. I only had maybe a short stint there. Had some decent guys that were around. Sean Gillum was a guy that I knew going into, you know, when I got there, that played in Lethbridge, in juniors and everything else. So I was familiar with Gilly a little bit when I got there. And the coach, he was a young coach, and he understood what my goals were, because I wasn't there for a good time. I was there just to get the... do what I had to do and get the fuck out is essentially what I wanted to do. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't being a prick to my teammates or anything like that. You know, I still did the teammate thing and everything else. But yeah, my goal wasn't to be there for that long. And Al McIsaac, who was the GM in Norfolk, which was obviously Chicago's farm team at the time, and Trent Yanni was the coach there, they were two pivotal guys in my corner that saw that potential of being that first round draft pick that could, you know, can play the game, but it can also play the physical element as well. And not be a liability, you know, play 20, 25 minutes or whatever it is, but never be a liability out there, but you can also, you know, fight if you have to. And we had a real tough team in Norfolk, those couple of years that I was there.
Yeah.
Sean Thornton obviously is probably the one that comes, you know, right to the top of the list.
Yeah,
Jackson was not a stop that I wanted, but I guess it was maybe a necessary one to really set things straight for myself.
Well, and like you said, with the East Coast, like, what is it? It's always easy come, hard to leave, right? Isn't that what it stands for?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, you get to Norfolk, and like you brought up the name Sean Thornton, and I mean, there was a guy, how he did it for that long at that like, he played, what, 600 games in the American League, and then, like, 600 more in the NHL, and won two cups, and fought everyone. What was he like? What was it like to be around Sean Thornton for those 3 years?
Never a dull moment. Like, we had such a, like, we never really had the superstar on our team, right? We had a real, like, Yanni Trent was, Jans was the only coach. We had no assistant coach at all. And it was just Trent. And he put a lot of trust in us as players to know what we had to do was our job. And it was a different feeling knowing that he had so much trust in us as players. And, you know, that's why he is where he is still in the NHL coaching, either be an assistant coach position, is he got to know each other. He got to know us on a personal level and what made us tick and what we needed to get motivated. Mind you, he didn't go through our phones or anything like that. Not that we had iPhones at the time, but, he'd bring us over to his house. We'd have, you know, dinners there and got to know Charlene, his wife, and everything else. So Sean was just another example of how to, you know, how he grinded it out for so long. And, you know, obviously with St. John's Maple Leafs for a certain amount of time. And then obviously with us and when I played with him in Norfolk, he was just a pillar of hard work. You know, I think Thornton would be the first guy to say, look, I didn't have the best skill. I wasn't the best at this. But one thing that no one could ever do was outwork him. And he always came into camp the best shape. And that was his statement of saying, you know what, I'm here. I took it serious. I'm here to do what I need to do to protect my teammates and to help my team win at whatever cost. Great guy off the ice. He had the smallest dog. Grazy was his name. It was a miniature Doberman, a miniature pincher, I think. You see, he has this dinky-less little dog. I shouldn't say anything at the time because I had a, you know, obviously being the size that I am, you know, I had a fucking pug at the time as well. So it was tough guys having all these small little dogs, but I guess it was just easy to travel with smaller dogs, I guess. But Thornton was such a influence of, you know, you wanted to play for the guy. You wanted to do whatever you wanted for that whole team. Ty Jones, AJ Baines, Marty Wilford, who's now an assistant coach with Buffalo, right? And had a stop in Anaheim as well, right? So, you know, you have these relationships. You maybe lose touch with these guys for quite some time, but you'd never, you know, you'd pick up where you left off. You know, if you see them 2 years to 5 years down the road,
but
Thornton, it wouldn't be any different.
Yeah. Well, you make it all the way back to, and you make the Chicago Blackhawks in 2003-04, you play 41 games. And the coach at the time was, of course, the legendary Sutter family, Brian Sutter. What was it like playing for him?
I love Sutty. I love playing for him, and, I still played for him even after I was playing senior AAA down in Innisfil with the Innisfil Eagles, the senior AAA league.
Yeah.
I thought you would say, hey, like, come on, Aches, come play for me, you know? And, you know, you can't say no to Brian. You can't say no to any Sutters, in a sense. But especially the connection that I had with Brian. But I remember Steve Sullivan, Sam Knob was on the team, Mark Bell, Kyle Calder. I know Calder and Belzy were okay with it, but I know Sully was a guy like, because he's intense. Sutsy would come in between periods and he'd fucking pace around the dressing room, and you know, especially if he didn't have a very good period, he'd be fucking staring guy like clenching his fists and he'd like, fuck, let's go, guys. You gotta, you know, he's pumping his fist in his other hand, and some guys didn't like that. Like, you know, it's just like. But I liked it. He'd say, like, come on, Aches, fucking get in there and just be hard. Just be hard to play against. Just be hard. It's like, you know, so, you know,
to me, it was a great time to be on that Chicago team, even though we didn't have the Wayne's records. But I love Brian. I still to this day love the guy.
Yeah, well, a couple other characters in that team, of course, Jason Strudwick and Ryan Vandenbush. There's some tough dudes right there.
Yeah, I remember Struds was, we're on the road. I can't remember exactly where we were, but he's like, you know, because we had Travis Moen coming up as yep. well. There's myself, there was Struds, there was Bushy. Just the four of us, or just name the four right there. I'm sure there's a few other guys that were coming up in the lineup as well. Struds was like, fuck, like, you guys keep fighting, I'm going to be out of a job here. Like, come on, like, leave something for me, because I, you know, he knew that was part of his game as well. You know, hard to play against, and he, you know, dropping the gloves was part of his role as well. But it was like, we just kind of trended up, and obviously, yeah, Sean was in there as well. 30 was in there as well, right?
Yeah.
So it was like, fuck. And I made the emergency recall after, I didn't know at the time when I was up with Chicago for most of the year. I didn't realize I was on an emergency recall for most of that time, because as soon as Steve Pops came back from injury, that's, you know, since he said, yeah, Aches, you know, I hate doing this. It's just a legality with the league. You're emergency recall. As soon as someone comes back up off the IR or whatever, we have to send that guy back down to the American League team, and you know, I don't want to do it. You've fucking done everything for us. I love having you on the team. I love you in the dressing room. All the good stuff, right? It was very positive, but it was just a numbers thing, and it was. But the time that I was there, I loved it. It was, you know, and then again, you know, come that end of the year, end of that contract, it was going into the lockout year. 04 and 05, and you know, my agent at the time, or I never got rid of my agent for my whole career, which, you know, it is what it is now, but I, you know, he said, yeah, Vancouver came in with an offer, a 2-year, the first year was a two-way, second year would have been a one-way, but I was kind of hesitant. I remember I was being hesitant with it because I loved Chicago so much with the guys, and obviously with Brian, but they were saying, you're not going to make no one's going to make more than 50 grand in the American League, because they knew there was going to be a lockout, right? So they didn't want anyone making whatever, you know, over 75 grand or whatever it was. And it was a 2-year deal that they gave me. And it was a 2-year, two-way deal, for both years. And I wanted to take that, but I got kind of talked out of it just because it was a one-way deal in Vancouver for my second year, which never came into fruition, right? But I regret not signing back with Chicago. I think, for me personally, I think looking back at it now, I found a home, but I also found part of my my game really fit in into the depth charts of the back end, which, you know, my agent at the time never really said, you know, it's better money here, just go here, right, type thing. Never really had that conversation of saying, hey, you know what, take a little bit less now, because 2 or 3 years from now, you'll have the potential of getting a one-way deal with Chicago. I never had that, so I kind of got, and that was my fault. I never challenged them, you know, in the sense of, you know, and you know, I should have challenged them, saying, you know what, do more homework, do better homework on this, and you know, but it's all hearsay now, Darren, as they say.
Well, like you said, your lockout year in Manitoba with the Moose, playing for Randy Carlyle. What was it like playing for him?
Fuck Kitty Carlyle. Yeah, fucking Kitty. He loved his fishing. And, you know, when you talk about, there's that clip with him and when he's in Toronto with Phil Kessel, right? About fuck you, you get on the bike. All this kind of stuff. All right. So, and he was exactly like that. He was all about getting guys back and just bickering with guys all the time, right? And he on our days off, like we didn't get a lot. The ones that we did, he booked ice fishing for us
on a day off in the middle of December or January in Manitoba, so it's cold as balls, and here we are going to this, you know, and he was always the guy. If you're 5 minutes early, you're 5 minutes late. So if you're not there in time, we had a bus that took us to this resort or wherever it was. It wasn't a resort, but it was ice fishing, you know, so me and Wade Brookbank shared a shack, and we had like a flat of beer in this. We put our sticks in there or whatever. We didn't fish. We just drank the whole day. And it was like, he did that a lot because he was a real outdoorsy guy. But fuck, we had so many, just player only meetings because not a lot of us liked Randy. You know, I think looking back at it now, the way he was and the way I was not taking my, my career seriously. Like I was my past life, my ex-wife was from Brandon, and with being in Winnipeg, I was doing a lot of driving between Winnipeg and Brandon, Manitoba, which was the wrong thing to do. So it never really set me up for a successful season. I had a little glimpses here and there. Bob Murray was the guy that was with the team with Vancouver at the time, and he was the one that really recommended them to sign me because he obviously came from Chicago as well, if I remember correctly. And he was, you know, I remember we were playing in Chicago against the Wolves, and we had a dinner afterwards, and he came up to me and said, "Hey, what's going on here? You're playing like shit. You're this, you're that. You're not doing this. You're not doing this enough." And then, you know, it was disappointing. I was disappointed in myself. Like, and obviously for him to come up to me and talk to me like that, like, he was just honest. He put his recommendation on the, you know, his reputation and recommendation on the line for Vancouver to sign me because he saw what I was able to do in Chicago for those 41 games. And, so there was some glimpses, some flashes in the pan that year with Manitoba where I did play well. But it never came. I never had an exit meeting with Steve Tambellini or anything like that. You know, I was a healthy scratch in playoffs. It wasn't looking good at that time, right? It was like, you know, so it is what it is, and you know, you live and learn. But you know, I guess that's why I got into, you know, lead into what I'm doing now. Darren is helping these young players and professionals understand, like, don't take a missed opportunity, regardless if it's a legit opportunity where you're actually playing at a certain level, American League or NHL or even East Coast. To take full advantage of it, right? And you know, and then I challenge the guys that I work with because I never got challenged where I wanted to, where I needed to get challenged. You know, I didn't know everything at that time, and then sometimes I did pretend that I did. So, Katie Carlisle, he was a fucking beauty, that's for sure.
Well, one guy, obviously, there's a couple characters. Well, you mentioned Wade drinking in the shack with Wade Old. He's been a guest on this show. Good dude. Also, Kevin Bieksa is on that team. What was he like?
Yeah, but he was my D partner. He was my roommate. Like, so when we went to Vancouver, was one of the few teams that had rookie camp that year. So I was out and I roomed with Juice for that camp, and then obviously playing with him, we were roommates on the road as well. Obviously, you know, the story that I heard, you know, once I was getting to know him in Vancouver for that camp was when he absolutely decked one of the Russians, when he came out of Bowling Green outside of Earl's restaurant in Winnipeg.
Fedorov.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Fedorov. Yeah, just one punched him, right? Just right outside the parking lot, right in front of the restaurant. He just decked him one. So Juice was always a guy that, you know, you knew where you stood with him. He was quick-witted, just what you see now with how he is. That's how he has always been. And, you know, it's great to see his personality, you know, come out. And he played like that as well, right? You know, and, obviously it was the start of his young career at that time. And, you know, you just got to know him. It was just, he's just a good guy. And yeah, the guy can play hockey, not just the fighting part of it. He was the full package.
Absolutely. For sure. Well, another name I have to ask you, of course, and I know he came up from junior. He didn't play a lot that year, just about 8 games. But I have to ask you. No, I'm still here. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
You there, Darren?
Okay, we're back here. I was going to ask you about the late Rick Rippon. Do you have any stories about him?
Yeah, I remember Rick. He came in from Regina to Manitoba, and again, very humble guy, very quiet from what I remember, but very humble, and he came in very, professional. And then obviously the first game that he played, he gets into a scrap with I'd have to look it up to see who he scrapped, but again, he kept throwing his rights, and he was just a kid that learned how to throw lefts, and he stunned the guy and buckled him in a sense in his first fight, and that made that impression with Randy at that time, obviously. And then you had guys like Burke was in the house, right? Because he was, obviously, they were obviously pretty close friends at the time, and Burke was coming into Winnipeg, and he came into the dressing room, more towards the end of the season and stuff. But Rick was a very quiet young man. He was 20, 21 at the time, and he came in there, just did his business, had a little grin on his face, and you knew he was going to go places. You knew he had that fire, that, he wanted to make it, and he knew how he had to make it, right? Unfortunately, I think he was, I feel for him and his family, not, he got robbed of, potentially a good career, a young, a hard career, but a good career at the same time.
Absolutely. Well, before we leave Manitoba, I have to ask you about one tilt. Do you remember your fight with Yablonski?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to remember it, to be honest with you. I don't think it was, from what I can remember, it wasn't a very good fight. Jeremy was a fucking, he was a tank, and he was one of the few guys that I, there's guys that hit hard. He hit hard. The one guy that I would recommend that not fighting was Mike Siglenka from Meadow Lake. I fought him when I was in Norfolk. We were using with the Phantoms, and that guy hit me probably 17 times to my one punch. And probably, on YouTube, you see the ladder of it, which is you see him totally manhandling me at that time. But he hit so hard, and the next guy that hit just as hard as him was Yablonski, for sure. Jeremy had he could pack a punch for the size that he was.
Yeah. Well, and another name, I didn't bring it up at the time. He ended up fighting him 4 times. And, of course, he's the American League all-time penalty minute leader and character he is in his own right, was Dennis Bonvy. What was it like fighting Bonvy, Bones, and playing against him? Because I'm sure he had a little Barnaby in him, too.
I remember, I fought him, when I played in Norfolk, he was in Binghamton. And every time teams came down to play us, they'd play 2-game homestand. We'd have a 2-game homestand against him. So I fought him, I think, 3 times in those 2 games. And talking to the Bones, he never lost a fight, right? He never lost a fight. He said, Aix, I'll beat you up again. I'll beat you up again. How does it feel when you get beat up by me all the time? I said, fuck, seriously, you never beat me. We fought. I won, whatever. But it was, I still talk to him because obviously he scouts with, he's a pro scout for Boston, right?
Yep.
So we reminisce and I say, we'll strap on the skates again and you can beat me again or whatever the case is, right? So it's all in good fun. And he was one of the guys that always, he'd wear the old Jofa helmet for practice. So we were in Binghamton one time and they're practicing before us. And I said to him, I was yelling from him from the bench or from behind the glass. I'm like, why don't you wear that in the games, you big fucking pussy or whatever it was, right? Just to kind of get out. And he's smirking away, right? And, in that time we had Louis DeBrusque was with the team as well, with us at that time as well, right? So
yep.
Big Lou was obviously played with Dennis Cape Breton, I think, with the Oilers, when they were with the Oilers as well. So it was, but yeah, every time you talked to Bones, it was, yeah, he won every fight that he was in. He never lost a fight.
Well, the following year, you're in Hamilton, in Montreal's farm team. And I was going to ask you, one of the guys, again, another guy that I had on the show, and I know you fought him a few times, and now your teammates is Pete Vandermeer.
No, Pistol Pete, yeah. Yeah, we fought a few times there when you were with the Phantoms. You know, and again, I think he was a lot like him and Rocky would be very similar. Not your big heavyweights, but would fight heavyweights because they were such good, smart fighters, right? They'd weigh you out. They'd tire the bigger guy would tire you out. But playing with Pistol in Hamilton was a breath of fresh air. You know, at that time you're coming out of, you know, Winnipeg and Vancouver's organization, and you're trying to find, you know, some reason to keep playing or to find the love for the game again, because you're just getting beaten down. You're, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. That's the nature of the beast, right? You're, but yeah, Pistol, I still played against him in a few games in senior hockey. He's still pulling the same shit, you know, slashing guys behind the legs, just being a shit disturber, right? But who's going to do anything, right? If you're gonna fight them, you better buckle up and be ready to put your best effort forward, right? And you're going to get a couple of licks, you know, you might get a couple of licks in, but I guarantee you, he's gonna outsmart you by the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at this point, you know, you're 27. And the following year, you go to Austria. Had you kind of made your peace with, like, the NHL's over? Like, the dream's over, kind of, at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, personally, in my personal life at that time, you know, I wasn't doing the things I wanted to do. What I should have been doing, you know, I kind of compromised with my past partner and this and that, and not wanting to piss anyone off. So I just kind of floated by, which was wrong. Like I really didn't take the bull by the horns and really take ownership of my career, regardless in what my personal life was like, in a sense of, you know, who I was, you know, married to, my, you know, my family or kids or whatever. I should have, you know, this is my job. It's a full-time job. It's not, yeah, you only get paid during the season and in playoffs, but it's a full-time job regardless. You got to stay on top of things or it's your job. And, you know, you have more and more younger guys coming in. And I never took it, I don't think I really took it serious enough, knowing that, you know, it'll work out, right? Like that's the kind of advice that I was getting from that part of my life was, oh, it'll work out. Don't worry. You got to go out and you got to get it. And you got to work hard for it. There's no just coasting by and getting the results that you want. You can't have excuses and results at the same time, as they say, right? So I had a few excuses, and looking back at it now, I obviously have a lot of regret when it comes to that. But at the same time, I did have a good time and, you know, a good experience at the very least in Austria. And even being over there, I could have extended my career to, you know, 4 or 5 years more if I wanted to. But, you know, I got influenced and talked into doing other things. And for that part of my life, I wish I took advantage of the teams that I was with, and obviously the places that I was in, and took more advantage of becoming a more well-rounded professional when I look back at it now.
Well, it was, you know, like you said, you played, you know, a long time in the American League, and you wrap it up in Austria. So at that point, you got to the NHL and had some tilts and had some stories and some memories for a lifetime. But I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing them. But what's Jonathan Aiken doing these days?
Well, I'm still in the business of hockey, just on the different side of it. I got my own company called Top Shelf Hockey Agency. So I'm working with obviously young kids that are, you know, either be your draft eligible for the Western Hockey League draft all the way up to pro guys. I got a few pro guys. My oldest guys are 21 now. They're one signed with New Jersey, a Utica. Jace Isley out of Red Deer. He's originally from Grand Prairie. He got signed with Utica there just the other day. Cole Dubinsky is within the Boston organization. He's starting out in with Providence and Maine in their East Coast League, in their East Coast League team. So I'm doing the agent thing, or advisor as you call it now, which was a real different word for me when I, you know, when I went through it, I was always an agent. Now with the guys that are wanting to go NCAA, you have to be tagged as an advisor. So I'm doing the agent advisor thing for the last few years, and yeah, it's a grind, but yeah, no matter if you're on the ice or off the ice, you have to grind it out. You have to work hard, and really it's cutthroat more so in this business than it is, you know, obviously if you have any disagreements on the ice, you can just drop the gloves and go at it. On this way, it's you know, a lot of these guys can be very detrimental, and they don't pull any punches in the sense of trying to discredit your reputation.
Yeah. Well, looking at it, like I said, from, I mean, obviously it's a broad answer. I mean, there's, you can go a number of ways, but you just look back at your WHL career and what you went through and how the game was played. I mean, what are the biggest differences now from when you were playing, do you think?
I just think, I think the accountability thing on the ice has changed. I think guys can take advantage of players, regardless if it's a skilled player or a fourth line player. I think you don't have that guy. Like a Sean Thornton, I think was a guy that was never a liability on the ice, and he could play the game within it. And Thornton knew how he had to play in order to be a contributing, not just on the, you know, with the fighting and being that police guy out on the ice, but he could score goals. He could play the structure of the game. So I think, obviously, with the way the league's going, you know, you got the Quebec League, you know, banning fighting now, and I don't agree with that. I think it's always good to have a guy out there that can play the game but can also hold guys honest, in a sense of, you know what, you're taking advantage of us, enough's enough, I'm going to hold you accountable. I don't think you have a lot of guys, as they get into the junior ranks, they may have that attitude and that in the minor hockey or U18 as they call it now, but once you get into juniors, you don't see a whole lot of line brawls or, you know, a whole melee of where guys play differently when they don't have to have that you don't have that.
Well, there's got to be a consequence,
scared,
right?
They're not scared.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no consequence at all. Like, I think you have a big hit. Yeah. Okay. You know, you don't have to fight after every big hit, but every big hit nowadays is like, you get a penalty for it. It's like, what do you mean you get a penalty for it? Right? Like, it's a clean hit. You know, like, you know, and if it doesn't happen right away, it'll happen at some point during the game, but you got to keep these guys on their toes. You know, I think the accountability thing and consequences is part of sports, especially team sports, right? If you didn't want any, you're going to have that even more so because you have, you know, 20-some players on a team. You're going to have 23 different consequences for 23 different players. If you're going to look at that, whereas you have consequences in golf and tennis. If you're not prepared, you're taking advantage of situations. You're going to pay for it. You know, obviously, that's the beauty of hockey. You know, you've always been able to hold guys accountable. I just think guys in this day and age, going against a guy like Dave Semenko or Dave Brown, these men among men, you know, it's like it's a big eye opener for a lot of these kids, right? Because they don't think they have that element to the game anymore.
No, absolutely. Well, I know you're pressed for time, and I want to thank you for taking the time today to sit down and talk to me about your career. And I know the people are going to dig this, so I'll let you go. But Jonathan, I want to thank you again very much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Darren. I appreciate it. It was great reminiscing about all these guys I played with and played against. So, no, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you people that don't like fighting, how many of you did you walk out and get a coffee while that was on?